The Guardian.
Hello. I'm not James Richardson. He's still in Botswana. Nor am I Max Rushton. He's still in Sweden. I'm Ian McIntosh. And look, I know what you're thinking. I know that no one likes change. So I'll say to you now what I always say to my wife. Why don't you just let me start? And if you really don't like it, I'll stop. Producer Ben, hit the music. On today's show, for the first time in Football Weekly history, we have a panel that cost more than the presenter. We'll be looking back at an emotional night in Stockholm and a historic treble for Manchester United. We'll be looking forward to the FA Cup final. Will favourites Chelsea record another routine victory over Arsenal? Or will they absolutely thrash them? Plus, we'll be lifting pint glasses of white wine to Big Sam, and we'll be discussing David Moyes leaving Sunderland. Whoever could have seen that coming? It's all on Football Weekly Extra. Well, what a panel I see here before me. It's pretty much a dream panel. The only noticeable absence of Felicity Kendall and Tony Hibbert. But in their absence, I am delighted to have European Football Show regular Paolo Bandini on the show. Paolo, thank you so much for joining us. How's the pod going?
Yeah, very good.
Excellent. They're not planning on cancelling it, are they?
not that I'm aware of, no.
Good. Why would they? It's a brilliant show. People need a good European football show. We also have James Horncastle. James, how are you doing?
Very good. I'm sure after this, it'll be very much a case of once you've had Mac, you never go back.
And on that unsettling note, our final guest, Michael Cox.
I'm excited by this. It's like when a player becomes player manager, we all have to kind of treat you a little bit differently now and not make jokes, but we'll gossip behind your back and get you sacked. Well, eventually.
Honestly, I don't think anything's changed there. Right, let's turn our attention first of all to Stockholm last night, a game which obviously took on new significance after the hideous actions of a reprehensible fraction of a man on the softest of soft targets. But in spite of all of the emotion, Paolo, Manchester United coped incredibly well with it, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. Football does not change or modify any of the sort of serious, horrible things that happen in the world. And that's not what it's for. It's, you know, football is what it always has been, which is a distraction. But I thought the United handled the whole event very well. They obviously shut down their plans for the press conference before. A lot of the sort of festivities around the game were shut down. But what they did do, Manchester United, was put together an extremely professional performance. And it was, you know, it was pure Jose Mourinho final football. You just, it's actually, you know, the quote that came to mind is one of his former charges, Samuel Eto'o quote, which is, you don't play a final, you win a final. And that's what Manchester United did. They didn't really leave anything open to chance. I think Ajax, you know, for a lot of the ball that they had, barely created anything in the entire game. Okay, United were probably a little bit fortunate to go ahead the way they did with that goal that was so heavily deflected off Davinson Sanchez, but it was just absolutely ruthless, in control, never allowing it to be at all in doubt.
Michael, you've got a piece up on The Guardian at the moment talking about the tactics behind the victory. What did Mourinho do? Because whatever he did it pretty well.
Yeah, it was kind of as we expected. Ajax had a lot of the possession. United sat back, counter-attacked sporadically. But I thought really the main feature was just how nervous Ajax looked. You know, obviously incredibly young side. And, you know, sometimes people don't believe in the concept of experience, but I thought that last night was a game where there was clearly a very nervous young side that needed a bit of a leader, someone who could take command, put his foot on the ball. And I mean, in the first 10 minutes, you know, I don't think it was a United strategy to press high up the pitch. But Ajax was so nervous and just so prone to mistakes that United did, you know, keep on doing that. And eventually that's what the first goal came from, really, from the kind of throw that you're taught at about 6 years old not to throw it into the box from that position. And United pounced, and from there, it kind of reverted to a counter-attacking performance. And you didn't really ever see Ajax getting back into the game.
Were you disappointed, James, by Ajax? You know, there'd been so much hype about them, so much talent. Did they let themselves down, or is this just, you know, what happens when you send out a team of schoolboys for a big game like that?
I mean, this team has done incredibly well to get this far, really, considering the kind of economic barriers that have been put up since we saw Ajax in the final in the Champions League in 1995, how difficult it's become for them to compete. For them to go about their their business, stay true to their style, and still bringing through players who I think, irrespective of last night, shouldn't be judged on last night. I think they've done very well. I mean, that had an average age of 22. You had Matthijs de Ligt, centre-back, who's 17, I think the youngest player to play in a final. I was disappointed, I would say, with the coach, Bosch, for the tactics. Basically, it was very much a kind of, we're going to play our own way, not adapt. And when that didn't work, they didn't really have anything, didn't have anything else. And it became quite easy for United. And, you know, Mourinho, again, I mean, I was watching this on Sky Italia, and he just loves to really play to the gallery when he comes into the for a post-match interview, and he just said, look, for me, it was exactly like the 2010 final, Inter against Bayern. From the very first minute, I knew we had it in the bag. And to be honest, considering how nervy Ajax did start, you did get that impression.
Of course, there were a lot of similarities there, because Mourinho did the treble that season as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And but I mean, again, in this particular interview, he was quite self-aware enough not to really claim it as it was like it's a mini treble. It's far, far away from the treble that I achieved with Inter. I've seen some United fans describe it as a Scouse treble from 2001. Which, yeah.
But he did seem to be making a bit of it, like sticking three fingers up in the celebrations, trying to get everyone to do it.
He really seemed to enjoy the win, much more than, say, I mean, when he first won the Champions League with Porto, and he famous, I mean, this is a guy who loves nothing more than throwing his medal into the crowd rather than keeping it. Yeah, and he admitted after the game that it's probably been his most difficult season. You know, I would imagine that was last season. But I think, yeah, because of that, he's felt he's not had to prove himself, but he's certainly had people pointing fingers and being sceptical of him for the first time in a long time, saying that he's lost his aura, that he's not the same manager. And in the end, I kind of agree with one of the points he was making, was that, you know, if our season came down to kind of getting into the Champions League, I'd rather do it winning a trophy than finishing third or fourth.
I mean, just on that last point quickly, I mean, it's sort of better in a multitude of ways, not least the fact that I was just noting this morning, I was reading somewhere, the fact is they've piled up so many coefficient points this season. Ironic is they've gone into the second pot now for the Champions League, when they might have been in the third or fourth, which actually makes a big difference. So yeah, it's significant.
All part of the master plan.
Yeah.
But what does it mean for how we see Mourinho and Manchester United now? Because, you know, it's a big gamble. They put everything on winning this. If they hadn't, they'd have looked very silly. But they did, so
yeah,
good season.
I mean, shit, isn't it, you know, ridiculous that the fractions that we build into these narratives now? Because, all right, this game was straightforward. It was never really in doubt. But that semi-final against Celta, the Guidetti chance that was actually a Bovo chance, really, before, I would say, more than it was a Guidetti chance at the end, that could be it. It could be all over. And we were talking about a season where, sure, he won the EFL Cup and all right, we're going to talk about the Community Shield as if it's a trophy now, which is a thing which has sort of crept in, I feel like, a little bit in the last few years, that we talk about it as a trophy rather than a pre-season friendly.
It's good news for David Moyes, though. Because there's a man who needs something on his CV right now.
Yeah, that's true.
He's got one third of a treble.
Yeah, that's certainly one way of looking at it. But yeah, I mean, it's everything. It's everything in the season. I think that's exactly why you saw Mourinho in that mood rather than the throwing medals into the crowd mood. He knows that without that win, this season would be drastically differently viewed.
So we'll see this as a profitable transitional season for Manchester United. Two cups, back in the Champions League, mission accomplished. How much, though, are the fans going to accept that sort of football? It's very reactive, very pragmatic football. Is he going to change next season?
I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, I think United fans will accept that in a final. I think the problem's been at home against poor sides. They haven't been proactive enough. They've created a lot of chances, to be fair, and often wasted them. I don't think United are too far away from being actually a really good team, but I think the progress next year will almost certainly come from a couple of individuals signed on, you know, a lot of money, rather than any great transition from Mourinho's perspective.
Well, the good news is that last night's success means that they avoid a penalty charge on their £70 million kit deal with Adidas. They would have that would have cost them £21 million, which I believe is roughly equivalent to Antoine Griezmann's right leg and ball bag. They are obviously going to be shopping extensively over the summer. Who are they going to be going for?
Well, it looks like people are more and more confident that Griezmann will be heading to Old Trafford than they were a few weeks ago. I think what he said, it was a 6 out of 10. And also, if you look at the kind of moves that Atletico are making at the moment, depending on, I think, what their transfer ban, whether that gets lifted or it being lifted gets upheld. Yeah, they seem to be keen on Lacazette and also Diego Costa again. So yeah, perhaps there's the conditions there for them to do a deal in that respect.
Well, United will go straight into the Champions League group stages. As Paolo says, they'll be second seeds. Liverpool, who have been out in Australia having a lovely time by the looks of things, they still have to qualify through that that qualifying round. But it does mean that there will be five English teams in the Champions League next season. Andrew McKay89 says, thoughts on Michael Owen's assertion that the quality of the EPL sides will see them launch an assault on the Champions League next year? James?
Well, I think... In United's case, this experience will have been useful for them. We've seen a number of teams go on and win the Europa League and then be able to transfer that form into the Champions League. Saw it with Atletico Madrid, for example. You could even say that we saw it with Juventus when they reached the semi-finals of the Europa League, then reached the final of the Champions League the following year. So that experience of going deep in a competition like this, knowing how to manage it and manage your squad, I think is helpful because it's... It's a long journey. It's a longer journey than to get to the Champions League final. You're thinking, what, 15, 16 games? Think of, yeah, the travelling. It's almost easier, the Champions League, in that respect, for logistical, how to manage your body, your rest and recuperation. So from United's point of view, I think this will serve them well. And also, you know, winning begets winning. I think whatever you say about Mourinho's season, whether he had to save it and it came down to the final day, he's brought back a winning culture to that club in winning this Scouse treble.
Paolo, of all the English sides, I mean, it's the usual suspects always getting to the top last four in the Champions League. Of all the English teams, who do you think will go furthest?
Instinctively, I want to say Chelsea, but actually Conte's time at Juventus, the Champions League wasn't his tournament. That was the one tournament where he wasn't getting it right. Now, I think he's evolved as a manager since then. I think he's a better manager than he was. Obviously, some of it's going to come down to investment over the summer, but weirdly, I could imagine it being United. I think being put in that second pot gives them a decent starting position, and I think that Mourinho, again, he knows how to win these games. He knows how to. It's not always the most delightful way of doing it, but he knows how to win these games.
Michael,
I don't know.
Excellent. Thanks for coming, James.
I would like to say Spurs, although Spurs continue to kind of disappoint in Europe.
They might be more used to playing at Wembley, I suppose, by the time the group stage games come around.
There is most definitely that. It's strange that, you know, the kind of best Spurs we've seen in Europe has been the Harry Redknapp, that Champions League, Inter Milan, taxi from Icon.
What a time it was to be alive.
But in all seriousness, how can we predict now? I mean, we don't know the composition of the squads. I know it's a hypothetical question.
Because you sat in Barry Glendening's chair.
Yeah.
Burn that chair.
Before we move on from this game, I just want one thing I want to pick up on Mourinho, because this is going to be one of the things that everyone's enjoyed riffing on the back of this game, that there are a lot of poets in football, but poets don't win titles. And I just don't know if I was the only person who, listening to him saying that while representing United, just immediately came into my head was, when seagulls follow the trawler, it is because they think sardines will be thrown into the sea. I mean, this is the club of the most poetic of our footballing title winners, surely.
Absolutely. Can't deny that. Well, that is part one. In part two, don't go away if you haven't already, we'll talk the FA Cup final. Welcome back. This Saturday is, of course, the FA Cup final at Wembley, Arsenal against Chelsea. Arsenal, not a great record against Chelsea, apart from one epochal game this season. I don't know if you've heard about it. They won 3-0. Michael, have they got any chance here?
I think Chelsea are strong favourites. I mean, they'd be strong favourites anyway by virtue of the fact they won the league. But Arsenal's defensive injuries are just so problematic. Well, not just injuries, obviously. Koscielny's suspended. Gabriel is out, and, you know, he's not been irregular, but I think this three at the back suits him. I think in the semi-final against City probably was his best game for the club. Mustafi has been suffering from concussion, is doubtful. That's not really a thing you can take risks with. So Arsenal may have to play kind of holding. They may have to play, well, Monreal's actually done quite well in the back three. There's speculation that Mertesacker, who's played 40 minutes all season, could start against Diego Costa. I just think that's going to be too much for Arsenal to get around, really.
I mean, there is a serious chance they won't actually have enough players to do the back three, isn't there? I mean, who is there anyone there who could slip in as an auxiliary? Steve Bould, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't think they have any midfielders who can drop back. I wonder if Wenger might consider going to the back four, just playing Monreal and holding and dropping Bellerin back. But
I mean, that's exactly the thing, isn't it? I mean, the back three, you say Monreal can play centre-back. I mean, even Monreal, are you saying that he can play comfortably in a back four as a centre-back? It's a reach. It's not like you sort of look at him and think, okay, that's his role. I think it's interesting, that sort of the point you make about the epochal game when, Arsenal sort of beat Chelsea and prompted this change to a back three. And then, of course, Arsenal's turnaround has very much been on the back of this back three, which now probably can't be deployed in the final. But I almost, it's the fact that I'm looking at that team and thinking, is the gamble on Mertesacker actually the best bet? Which it might be if you're opting even back four, as I say, you're opting between Monreal and Mertesacker in a back four, who are you more comfortable with there? It speaks to a situation that is definitely not desirable.
Yeah, the last time Mertesacker played against Chelsea was the sending off for a serious professional foul on Diego Costa, so... By all means, go Wenger.
Chelsea, by contrast, are pretty much fully fit, aren't they? Do you think there'll be a starting place for John Terry?
No, I don't. I was lucky enough to be at Chelsea's training ground a couple of days ago, the atmosphere there was very, very bright, to say the least. I think, Conte, if he could, he would have played that final there and then. He doesn't like the waiting. He was speaking about, for example, just getting into his players' heads and refocusing their minds for this game. I don't think there'll be a problem with that. I think he's very good at getting into his players' heads and getting exactly what he wants from them. I think from their point of view, if Arsenal don't, if they go away from the back three, it might be a problem for them, because when they played each other in the spring, Chelsea won 3-1, and I think one of the problems that they caused Arsenal that day was that when Chelsea really get going forward, you have the wing backs bombing on, and you've got the three players up front. You have essentially four Arsenal defenders against five Chelsea forward players, and that caused them all kinds of problem that day. So I think if they were to actually go ahead and mirror Chelsea, it might actually do Arsenal better.
That's sort of almost like how the back three, it feels like, has spread in Italy. It's certainly true. And then I feel the same thing sort of happened in England this season, where I was reading that somewhere earlier, that only three teams in England haven't used the back three at some point in the season. And mirroring is part of it. Like in Italy, that sort of certainly was a big driving factor in more and more teams using the back three, was they realized that up against the back three, it's really hard to counter without just doing the same thing. Which is why, again, if you're talking about shuttling Monreal into a back four or just trying to improvise the back three, I almost am inclined to say we'll try and improvise the back three, because at least the shape works, even if the personnel is a stretch.
Now, it's mixed results between these two. The last meeting at Wembley between Arsenal and Chelsea was, can anyone guess?
Community Shield. When Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain scored the winner, and he's another player who's doubtful. But if he's fit, I think he could be really important for Arsenal. I think cup finals are often decided just about energy, and it's going to be a hot day. And Chamberlain's done quite well just getting up and down the pitch. I think he's maybe, before his injury, was Arsenal's best performer for about a month or so. So he could be big if he's fit.
So you're saying there's a chance?
A very different Chelsea side, of course, yeah.
And also worth remembering the 2007 League Cup final. Anyone remember that?
Yes,
when John Terry fight.
Yeah, and John Terry got booted in the head by Abu Diaby, didn't he?
He did. He landed just sort of
did
entirely
Diaby get injured?
Board-like. Yeah, Diaby, yeah. Diaby broke his ankle, which might actually have been the first of a string of 26 injuries that robbed us of the real Diaby. John Terry knocked out cold and yet still turned up for a pint at the celebrations afterwards.
Fair play.
In full kit.
Speaking of John Terry, and we were speaking about him on Monday, about his controversial substitution, he has issued a statement. He said, "I couldn't care less, I promise you. All I care about is celebrating with my Chelsea fans. Me and them have a wonderful rapport and have done for 22 years. That's the way I want to go out. That's the way I go out, because I've been here 22 years. I've won so many trophies. So if I wanted to play 1 minute and come off, I would have done. I was over the moon with the reception. I promise you, I could not care less." Do you think he cares? I think he does a bit.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of kind of like a teenage girl's Facebook profile, doesn't it? I don't care what anyone thinks of me, that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? It's been quite pathetic, I think. But there you go.
So it's almost pre-Facebook. It's very Bebo, you know.
Yeah. Now there's a name I've not heard in a long time. Do you think now he has sort of tarnished things a bit, or is he right? Chelsea fans aren't really going to care.
Yeah, I don't think Chelsea fans will care, and I think it's actually consistent. It's something that we've seen that's in his character. You know, this is JT. I was expecting something along these lines. I was just surprised that someone like Antonio Conte would go along with it. Although, I suppose we did see kind of similar but understated and much more elegant when, for example, he brought off Del Piero on his final game for Juventus, and Del Piero then just basically went round the pitch whilst the game was still going on. I thought that was much better, actually, but yeah.
It was extraordinary. People were throwing him scars like he was sort of flowers on the stage of an opera. It was amazing. It was one of the memorable. Yeah.
Of course, it could be the last game in England, at least for the foreseeable future, for two of the team's best players. Diego Costa, do you think he'll leave, Michael?
Yeah, it seems likely that he'll go to China. I think he's been kind of angling for a move. Not sure he came that close in January, but it'd be interesting to see how Chelsea replace him, because they've got Batshuayi there. He's provided some kind of quite crucial contributions in the last few weeks, and he's just a very exciting player. So it'd be quite interesting if they just are forced to evolve and Batshuayi is the one to step up.
And Alexis Sanchez, Paolo, he's been linked with a move for a very long time, since he started having temper tantrums in about September. Is this it for him as well?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, look, on top of a situation that has already been dragging on for a long time and hard to negotiate, Arsenal now have lost the leverage of, hey, you get to play in the Champions League. So it's going to be a difficult summer for Arsenal with still him and Ozil to work out. And I certainly wouldn't bet my house on him staying at this point.
And of course, finally, success or failure, could this be the end for Arsene?
I don't think so. No. I don't think he's going anywhere. I think he's going to sign another 2-year contract.
If he does that, if they lose to Chelsea and he signs a new contract, because there isn't really going to be a good time to announce that.
No.
How will that go down?
I'm sure it will go down as everything has gone down for a while, which is that there'll be a very vocal section of the fan base who will protest it very loudly and angrily. It was interesting that the final game, the objections seem to have taken a distinct turn towards Kroenke and away from Wenger. Like the protests were much louder against Kroenke than, you know, there was a couple of people holding banners against Wenger. It was like everyone had sort of just shifted focus a little bit, and I don't know if that would continue to be the case. Not that it's going to make any difference there either, because Dan Kroenke, as he's made abundantly clear already, quite likes the investment he's made, which is unsurprising, because the shares have gone up by about, what, 40-50% since he bought them, so he's making money.
Michael, they said Arsene wouldn't spend money, and he spent money. They said he wouldn't adapt tactically, and he shifted to a back three. Can you actually see a way out for him here? Could he make this all right?
They said he couldn't win the Premier League anymore, and he can't win the Premier League.
Give him time, James. Give him time.
So how do you mean a way out in terms of an improvement? Could they return to past
glories? Could he keep his job and take Arsenal back to the top?
Well, slightly controversial. I think he's actually improved as a manager over the last 3 or 4 years. I think Arsenal a few years ago were incredibly predictable. They literally just did play the same way every time. And now they've got better players. I think their tactics are more flexible. I just think the competition has raised so much in the Premier League. Arsenal got more points this season than they did last season, but everyone else is now good this season. I mean, it feels like last season really was Arsenal's chance. And, you know, the fact that they're not in the Champions League and they will find it more difficult to attract top players means that I think it's an uphill struggle for them now.
It's interesting that you talk about the evolution of tactics in the Premier League. I mean, a lot of people have ideas about this sort of thing. I mean, do you know anywhere I could go to find out a history?
Well, yeah, I mean, since you ask, Ian, and since you're doing such a fine job so far, I actually got a present for you. There you go.
Oh.
What is that?
Oh, it's a copy of The Mixer by Michael Cox, a story of Premier League tactics.
Hey, look,
from
I don't
to
want anyone
nine.
To feel
He's
left
got
out.
For everyone. Oh, thank you, Cox. You like that? Ben Littleton likes it. Duncan Hamilton likes it. Philippa Clare likes it.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's out next Thursday. I think it's a good fun book. It's quite long, but it's packed with anecdotes.
It's very big.
So, yeah, I hope you'll enjoy it.
Oh, well, I very much look forward to that. And you can find that in all the usual places, dear listener. And you can find part 3 after this.
Football Weekly's official shaving partner Cornerstone have just launched their brand new razor. There's no gimmicky name, but it's born of an obsession to design a classic razor that gives you an even closer, smoother shave than ever before. Try it for yourself and take £10 off your first order at cornerstone.co.uk/guardian.
My God, you're still here. God bless you. It's part three, and there's actually been a lot of things happening this week. David Moyes went. He's gone. Is that a bit sad, Michael?
For who?
Well, I think his decline has been really sad. I think it's been almost forgotten that he did do a very good job at Everton. He took over them when they were near the bottom of the league. He turned them into a kind of, you know, on the fringes of the European battle. And he just seems to have really been really badly affected by his time at Manchester United. And he was always considered a kind of a very bright manager, a manager who wanted to further himself. And you just look at what's happened since United. He seemed really scared by that task. Went to Spain, which seemed like a good move, but then there were reports he hadn't really moved out of his hotel. He wasn't really bothering with the language too much. And now, I mean, Sunderland's just been a real disaster. And maybe it's not much of a consolation, but the fact he resigned and didn't want compensation is relatively rare in the last few years. There's lots of managers who have almost just stuck around to get their payoff. He clearly doesn't want that. I genuinely think it's really sad. And I hope he takes a bit of a break from the game and maybe comes back in a couple of years and reinvents himself.
But I mean, tactically, he pretty much did all the tactics one by one throughout the entire season. And nothing seemed to stick at all, did it?
Yeah, it just didn't feel like a great match. And Sunderland have just relied so much upon sacking their manager midway through the season and rejuvenating themselves, but obviously they replaced Allardyce before the season, and I guess we're going to come on to him as well.
We certainly will, but not before we go through the shortlist. Paolo, Kevin Phillips has been linked. The bookie's favourite is Aberdeen's Derek McInnes. Stefan Schwartz is also interested, apparently. Who would you go for?
I don't honestly know. I think that there's obviously, as soon as you hear the name Kevin Phillips, there's an emotional attachment with the club, and perhaps given some of the sort of stories that went around about Moyes while he was there, that he was sort of taking the energy out of the club, that he wasn't popular with the staff and with the players, and it was something that was a bit fractious. Maybe you think that someone like that, who's a healer potentially for the club because he's got that reputation with people there and can bring things together. On an emotional level, that sounds right, but I mean, I can't really speak to his qualities as a coach, whether or not he's up to what will be a challenging season, getting things sort of switched around again and turned on for a strong season in the Championship.
Now, you remember last summer, after Aston Villa went down, Ian Holloway had the temerity to say they could go straight down again. Got himself quite a mouthful of abuse from a number of people, including the Villa chairman. Do you think there's a chance of this happening to Sunderland? Should say, it's like Holloway wasn't that far off. There was a point where they were losing games in the springtime. Yeah. It did look like they might happen. But could it happen to Sunderland as well?
Well, I think the financial situation at Sunderland is very difficult. You talk about Moyes not taking any compensation. I think, you know, maybe perhaps that was an awareness of just how straightened things are there.
Do you think he got to take anything, like a bit of furniture or Brian Oviedo or something like that?
A mug. But that's the thing. I mean, you look at his business. I mean, that was another thing that was kind of led to this impression of things just being so uninspired at Sunderland, just like, and really, I think, damaged how the perception of Moyes, how he just kept going back to players he'd had at Everton. Mm. As though he's trying to repeat the same trick and hope that it would come off. There didn't seem to be any kind of new ideas there. And as Michael said, you know, for someone who'd been in Spain in Real Sociedad, he hadn't seemed to evolve. But to go back to your original question, we were talking about how the Premier League has become even more competitive at the top end with the kind of coaching now that a number of clubs, the depth of coaching. I think it's the same in the Championship, relatively speaking. It's becoming, I think there are some really interesting managers down there who are taking clubs which, you know, in terms of resource and other things, you might not necessarily tip to be favourites at the start of the season. And they're going there because and are making promotion pushes because of triumphs for coaching. Yeah. Rafa Benitez goes down there, but we're talking about people in the playoffs now, David Wagner, Jaap Stam, even Gary Monk, what the job that he was doing at Leeds. It's a very difficult league to get out of.
I should just say one job vacancy has been snapped up already, the Norwich job. They've just appointed Borussia Dortmund's Daniel Farke. There's no way we can make anything funny out of that name, so we'll move very swiftly along.
A Colombian rebel, yeah.
Michael.
No, just say I'm excited to hear that Stefan Schwartz is in the mix, because when he was at Sunderland as a player, he was famously banned from space travel.
Was that a possibility?
He'd signed up to a kind of future program for the first ever kind of trips into space, like tourist trips into space. Sunderland weren't happy with this, and it was explicit in his contract that he was not allowed to go. And I'm just intrigued to see whether that applies to a manager or whether, well, whether he's got a bit more freedom.
Some of the manifestos that have come out.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. UKIP making a bold play for the resource mining of the Jovian asteroid belt today. they've got very exciting.
Perhaps they'd have Stefan Schwartz's vote on that basis.
Well, exactly. Yeah. This whole thing links up quite nicely. Maybe he won't even be available for Sunderland. But I follow the sentiment of the room. I think it's sad as well for David Moyes. But where do you think he'll go next? I mean, there is a World Cup coming up. Is he going to be one of those managers who pops up randomly?
Well, I did think Barcelona. I mean, he did resign just as Barca were also communicating that they were going to make an announcement of their new manager, but as did Allardyce. I think both of them pushing themselves into the frame for that job. Even going abroad now hasn't really worked for Steve McClaren. McClaren came back and I was listening to, I think it was a Radio 5 Live documentary on the lack of English managers. An English manager not winning the league since Howard Wilkinson, and McLaren was talking about his experience in Holland, and he was describing things that were revelatory to him, which just should sound normal to like top end coaches.
What, like?
Well, just like positional play and really? Just general kind of organisation. My mind was blown really by how this kind of, again, kind of organised, sort of coordinated pressing. And I didn't really understand how this should be new to a manager who'd managed England. And
Newcastle fans right now screaming, we knew it! We knew it! Let's move on, though, to Big Sam. Christ, he's had a year, hasn't he? Saved Sunderland from relegation, 67 days with England, 5 months with Palace, saved them for relegation. Now I think he wants to retire. What have you made of this, Coxie?
I can completely understand his mentality. I mean, the England job was essentially always going to be the peak of his career. And I think it's quite sad for him that he only lasted 67 days. Personally, I think it was very harsh. He was dismissed for what he did. But we don't need to go over that again. I think he probably didn't want to end on that. He wanted to end on a high. And he took over Palace in really quite a difficult situation mid-season and just sorted them out by the end of the season. Of course, they sealed survival with a really impressive, memorable victory over Hull. And if that's the way he's going to go out, then I think it's kind of what we should remember him for. He was a manager who took over often struggling teams and just meant that they were never in danger of relegation. I think he's a fascinating manager, very kind of primitive in terms of his on-pitch tactics, but his work behind the scenes, particularly at Bolton, was genuinely revolutionary. Really interesting character. I hope he's not gone from the game completely.
James, what will you miss most about Big Sam?
When he beats a top six manager, that's what I miss. Just the lording over it. I remember when I think it was Rafa Benitez's first game as Chelsea manager, and they went to West Ham and he beat them. Actually, he beat them, not West Ham. And he was asked if he had any sympathy. I think because Rafa was getting stung, he's like, "No, I don't have sympathy." Fantastic. I loved and how he'd just spend maybe 20, 25 minutes giving you a very in-depth tactical breakdown of how he, in his own phrase, out-tacticked that manager.
I love
Big Sam.
Have you got a favourite Big Sam moment? Is it the pint glass of white wine?
Well, I was thinking we haven't mentioned pints of wine yet. Or indeed, that video of him doing his dance on holiday where he's pumping his fists above his head, which is beautiful. And indeed, since we're doing plugs in this show, I read a piece by a certain Ian McIntosh on ESPN about Big Sam, referencing how Steve Bruce was so eager, understandably, from these little glimpses we get into Allardyce's partying life, so eager to get to Sam Allardyce's 60th birthday party that he basically bailed on his whole team after a match in the dressing room and went and got on the tube in London because he wasn't going to get to the train quick enough if he waited for the team bus. So he literally dashed out just to go have a party with Big Sam.
We can only imagine what happened that night at that party.
What's Big Sam's villa called? It's got a name, hasn't it?
Cassis St. James's, isn't it? From the compensation payment he got from that, like that very long, unfulfilled Newcastle contract. Let's turn back to Palace, though. They're now looking for their ninth manager in 5 years. Who wants that job?
I think it's probably a decent job to take, actually. I think their squad's quite good. They've had the defensive organisation from Allardyce. I think if they keep their best players, particularly Zaha, who I think could be off because he's just had a fantastic season. I imagine there's a lot of managers who'd want to take that. And, you know, you can't underestimate the fact that people are attracted to London as well. So that's something in their favour over other clubs of a similar stature in the Premier League.
Roberto Mancini is in the mix, apparently. Do you think he'd work out Selhurst Park? Depends if they got the hairdryer.
Well, Mancini wants to be back in England, without doubt. I think he never wastes an opportunity to state how much he loves working in this country and how he thinks it's the best league in the world, also because it mellowed him out and he became
really?
An English gentleman. Yeah, by Mancini standards.
Okay,
yeah,
fair enough.
As soon as he went back into Italy, he did become kind of Michael Douglas in Falling Down. I think the idea of living in London would appeal to him. But I think also Marcus Silva is mentioned whenever a vacancy comes up now.
Yeah.
And whether it's the Watford job or the Palace job, it seems that talks have collapsed between him and Porto.
Yeah, what happened there? He was supposed to get the Porto job, but now, alas.
Well, I mean, if you look at Porto, their financial situation kind of dictates that they sell and bring in a lot of money in the summer. So even though they're in the Champions League, they finished second this year, I think it'll be a difficult job. And his intention always seemed to be to use the whole job as a stepping stone to something bigger and better in the Premier League. Now, whether in Palace and Watford are that, I think Southampton seemed like a good fit, but that there isn't a vacancy there at the moment. So,
the other Italian manager who I've seen linked this Palace job is Ranieri, of course, who's kicking around waiting for a job and doesn't seem like he's finished with football, even if football sometimes seems to be wanting to pat him on the head and say, you've won your title now, wouldn't it be a good time to stop?
Yeah, is it worth the risk?
If what you like doing with your hours at 65 is managing a football team and you're, you know, pretty good at it, why shouldn't you do it? Even if it's going to sort of bother some people that the last thing you did wasn't to win a trophy.
Palace's only previous foreign manager was a former teammate of Mancini's. Attilio Lombardo.
Assisted by Thomas Brolin, wasn't
yes.
it? For the sole purposes of translation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Lombardo is now Sinisa Mihailovic's assistant at Torino.
Nice. Let's look at transfers, because Youri Tielemans has just joined Monaco for €25 million from Anderlecht. Could have joined bigger clubs. Do you think he's made the right move there?
Depends to an extent what they keep around him at Monaco. I think this is going to be a really fascinating summer. The fact they're spending that money suggests they're definitely expecting some coming in, which is no surprise. It's very clear that the Monaco business model is to buy and sell and keep moving players on. Look, Monaco played some hugely entertaining and extremely effective football this season. So if the core is maintained and if Jardim's still managing the club, then why not?
Okay, fair enough. Now this one surprised me quite a lot. Real Madrid have signed 16-year-old Vinicius Junior for €45 million. He only made his first team debut for Flamengo 2 weeks ago and came on for a whole 17 minutes. But he has been a big star for Brazil's under-17s. And I'm told he's quite good on Football Manager as well. does anyone know anything about him in the room?
I mean, he's still a minor, so they can't play him for 18 months as well. So in addition to only having 20 minutes of first-team football under his belt, it's one of those things where players that young still have to kind of grow and develop into their bodies and their talent, and then that can affect their talent as well. But I think Real Madrid in this case kind of want to be more proactive in getting a talent that who is now being billed as the next Neymar and not miss out on that kind of player again. But
is there a risk that he might just be the next Odegaard.
Odegaard.
Because not only, I mean, you kind of understand that he hasn't developed that quickly. He's still, I think, 13 years old. But his mere presence at the Real Madrid training ground, apparently, according to people around there, caused a bit of rancor because of the difference in wages. Is there not a risk that Madrid are just going to do the same thing here?
Yeah, I mean, I think Odegaard is definitely the kind of example to point out that that has just been a massive mistake in his career choice, and it hasn't done anything for his development. And I think particularly when that you're at that age, you need to make the right choice about where you go. And yeah, you look at for example players like just mentioned Tielemans, for example. You might say Tielemans is ready to go to a club in the Premier League, but I think Monaco have shown themselves to be very good at developing young players. It's the same with Dortmund. Dortmund have a reputation for being great at developing talent and preparing them for another jump forward. If I was Vinicius, I would maybe be thinking about going there. But apparently there's some pressures on him because I think the club were aware that there was already a big queue for him. And the club, Flamengo, wanted to basically give him a new contract but increase his release clause to 65 million. I think it was already 32 million and lots of clubs were willing to pay that, and they were even within that able to hold an auction. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if, don't quote me on this, he doesn't fulfil his potential.
I think there's just one thing sort of off the back of that, which is Real Madrid specifically. It was a comment that always stayed with me was Alvaro Morata, when he came to Juventus, remarked on how amazing it was that he was allowed to sit at lunch with Buffon and sit at lunch with all these senior players, and that was just perfectly normal. And that's like, okay, that's a positive comment about Juventus, but what does that say about Real Madrid, that Morata, when coming up through the system in Madrid, didn't feel like he was allowed to sit with the biggest players? So that sort of thing makes me think, is that the best place for a young player to be if it's still like a segregation, a hierarchy of who's allowed to spend time together?
That's just made me feel really sad. Poor Morata. Let's return, though, to a long-running theme in the history of Football Weekly: amusing injuries. Because Manchester United's loanee Guillermo Varela, who was supposed to be playing in the German Cup final for Eintracht Frankfurt against Borussia Dortmund on Saturday, is no longer doing that and is no longer welcome in Frankfurt after a tattoo-induced injury ruled him out. In spite of manager Niko Kovac ordering him not to, the fullback opted to get some art inked into his arm this week, and now it's infected. So well done, Guillermo. I had a similar thing at university when I had my ear pierced. Yeah. I had a bolt through the top of my ear. It was very much all the rage in those days. And within a week, I had what was essentially a kind of pus-filled golf ball weighing my ear down. Had to get it lanced. Hideous process.
And which game did you miss because of that?
I missed Falmouth Town again. No, I never got picked. Pretty terrible at football, to be honest. round the table then, favourite funny injuries in football history. Who wants to start?
Oh, I liked Cannizzaro's dropping an aftershave bottle on his foot just before the 2002 World Cup, because I feel like he probably went to control the ball, because I know I've done similar. I've dropped something instinctively. You try and kind of, you know, show off your first touch.
Goalkeepers should never, ever try to control the ball. James?
This was never actually confirmed, so it could be an urban legend, but Philippe Mexès, I think, damaged his eye whilst on the tanning bed.
Nice.
Which, if anyone saw him in that period of his career where he was very orange, kind of suits, yeah, it fits.
And Paolo?
Well, again, I think this falls in the unconfirmed category, but there was a Kevin Prince-Boateng, Melissa Satter, too much sex situation going on for a little while, which was keeping him out. But wasn't, I was just looking this up because I remember
Cardi as well.
Wasn't it David Batty who had a run-in with his daughter's tricycle? I need to look it up to get the details on that.
This much I do not know.
Yeah.
Always rather a fan of Kirk Broadfoot with the egg in the microwave. favourite safety tip: do not put raw eggs in the microwave. Producer Ben would like to add for the record that his favourite is Alex Stepney, who famously dislocated his jaw shouting at his defenders. A worthy addition to the pantheon. That is the end of part three. Join us for part four. Right, Let's have a few plugs and messages. First of all, Stephen Sweeney is in touch. He's off to Rome on Sunday to watch his favourite player ever for the final time. Totti, obviously. Who would you guys cross land and sea to watch one more time?
I don't think you can really beat Totti for this. It's just, it's the perfect kind of thing. Just the city as well. It feels genuinely like a pilgrimage. I'd say a kind of similar kind of player, roughly similar era. I was a massive Rui Costa fan, and his the ovation he got from Benfica when he left them for the second time to retire was fantastic. So we'd love to see that.
James?
Yeah, I mean, I would say Totti. I would be there if it weren't for the fact that I'm recording the last ever European football show.
Tragedy mounting on tragedy.
I'm going to go to the BT Sports studio to see the last year's
By all means, you're invited. I mean, if Diego Maradona says the best player he's ever seen is Francesco Totti, then
Go along with that, can't we?
I think so.
Paolo?
I mean, sort of beyond the glaring, the obvious ones, who I have been fortunate enough to watch. Obviously, if I hadn't seen Leo Messi in my lifetime, I think that's the player you want to. If we're allowed to go back in time, as Michael has, and again, he's someone I did get the chance to watch a lot, and indeed wasn't one for travelling across the seas, but Dennis Bergkamp was a player who just, even when it wasn't working for Arsenal as a team, was always just wonderful to watch.
Oh, I'd like to add Kirk Broadfoot at Stan Collymore. Stan Collymore at Southend. Absolutely ridiculous gulf in talent between him and anyone else on the pitch at that time. He was a wonderful, wonderful player. However, we haven't got time to indulge me, my Southend memories, because Juventus have won the Scudetto for the sixth straight year, says Peter Nichols on Twitter. Assuming this can't last forever, which I wouldn't rule out, which side is the most likely to topple them? Paolo?
If it was to happen next season, which I wouldn't, stake your house on, but if it was to happen next season, I'd probably say Napoli. I think that if you exclude the results in the month of October, which was the month when Milik got injured and they were trying to work out what to do up front and Mertens hadn't settled yet, basically since then they've been the best team in the league, actually, and they've been playing some just outrageously good football. There are some caveats to that, not least the fact that just last night Aurelio De Laurentiis managed to offend everyone at the team's end of season dinner, so who knows if they'll all still be there next season.
What did he do?
Well, the full details were not public because it was a private team dinner, but Pepe Reina certainly came out posting some pointed remarks on Twitter, as did his other half. Seems like De Laurentiis managed to offend the player who's sort of viewed as, he's not the most important player in the team, but one of the most important players in the dressing room, one of the most sort of bringing everyone together, well-loved characters in the team.
Any indication? Did he offer to show them his elephant impression?
Well,
because that can go down very badly.
Previously, because Pepperoni did obviously leave the club and come back, he managed to upset them by suggesting that it was all about Pepe Reina's wife hating Naples, which is pretty much the opposite of what's true. His wife really likes Naples, unlike some other wives of players on that team. But it was, you know, the papers have reported it was something remark on regarding his family life. I'm not going to get into speculation of things that are a bit, speculated.
Not a problem at all. James, who can topple Juve?
Kind of with Paolo, I think, but I think in terms of resource, you'd probably have to say Inter. But the problem with Inter is that they just make all the bad decisions of how to use that resource. There's a lot of muddled thinking and confusion at Inter, but the basis is there for them to be competitive. It's just whether they can actually find the right manager and kind of find a manager and players who can affect a change in culture in the team and bring a winning mentality back to that club.
Well, I mean, that was sort of why I said Napoli for next season. I think the thing which is interesting is when you look at the year-on-year revenues of these clubs, which in the end will give you an indication of which teams should be competing at the top. Roma have come up a lot in recent years, but that's essentially because of their revenue they're getting from European football. Inter and Milan are still able to get commercial revenues that no longer keep up with Juventus, because Juventus have pulled ahead of everyone, but are streets ahead of everyone else in the division. So if they ever get their acts together and start generating other forms of income, it'll snowball and they can be huge clubs again. But both of them have been so badly run for so long that, you know, you're not holding your breath anymore.
Coxie, I know you keep up to date with European football. Well, this season, be a damn sight harder next season. One-word answer, who's got the easiest chance of knocking Juve off?
I'll be positive unless they all happen next season, in which case Napoli.
Lovely stuff. Right, if that sort of red-hot Calcio chat set your pulse racing, make sure you get your ticket for Gazzetta Football Italia Live. It's happening at Union Chapel in Islington. Jimbo's hosting, along with Paolo and the Horn Dog. There'll be newspaper reviews and puns, galazzos and gelatos. And there's even a Serie A quiz to kick things off. You can get your tickets at theguardian.com/footballweekly. When is that, by the way?
It's in June.
In June. Excellent. That's all the information we need. Just keep turning up every night. They're bound to let you in at some point. It's a final call too for Football Weekly Live in Dublin at the National Stadium. Now, we have got a date for that. That's Wednesday, June the 7th. Jimbo will be hosting. Barry will be there. Barney will be there. Amy Lawrence will be there. You need to make sure you're there too. Get all over that. But before we go, because I know Huddersfield and Reading fans will be already penning their missives for the comment box, let's talk about the playoffs. Let's talk about Blackpool versus Exeter, first of all, in the League Two playoffs. Anyone got anything interesting to say on that? Anything? Blackpool owners getting themselves in trouble again with a few angry riposts to fans. They do tend to be quite litigious, though, so we won't say anything more on that, because, you know, maybe I might want to be on air again at some point in my life. Let's move then straight to Huddersfield Reading. That is, of course, on Monday. Reading are managed by Jaap Stam, who really did win a treble for Manchester United. Huddersfield for the sort of mini Klopp that is David Wagner. Who's your favourite here, Coxie?
From what I've seen, I think Huddersfield are the slightly better team. But when I've seen Reading, they offer controlling games, and I feel like that might be quite suited to this kind of playoff final. People think that playoff finals are always, you know, incredible end-to-end, scrappy goal fest. But in recent years, they've been quite tight and quite almost boring, and I feel like that might suit Reading.
I mean, Huddersfield are crackers, aren't they? They finished with a -2 goal difference.
Yeah.
They're brilliant, effusive, attacking, counter-attack, all over the place, running at full speed. I actually thought they would run out of batteries and not make it this far, so it's fantastic see them getting here.
And clearly Wagner has, I think, changed how people go about recruiting managers in that league. We've mentioned earlier about Norwich going after the Dortmund under, I think, 23 coach. I think he was Wagner's successor. And then you've got one alumni of Dortmund basically who could take this team into the Premier League. And then already in Germany, the under-19 coach of Dortmund has just taken Stuttgart up. So,
nice.
You know, we talk in the Premier League about, you know, the Italian coaching school, Coverciano, you know, these guys basically who you should get to win the league. You know, if you want to get promoted out of the Championship or be at any second division in Europe, you know, go for a Dortmund youth team coach.
Well, it would be lovely to see the Terriers back in the top flight. It'd be the first time since 1972. There was a poll, actually, on Huddersfield's website for their greatest ever player. Any of you guess who Huddersfield's greatest ever player was? 36% of the vote, it was Ray Wilson of England 1966 fame, closely followed by Tottenham Hotspur legend Andy Booth. Of course, who David Pleat signed on loan. That concludes this very special edition of Football Weekly Extra. Special in that half the audience turned off within 15 seconds. I am very much afraid to say, though, there is no pod on Monday. But on Friday, tomorrow, if you're listening to this hot off the press, I'll be back with Football Weekly Meets. I'll be interviewing filmmaker Dan Gordon about his documentary on George Best. Woof. Well, it only remains for me to say thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thank you, producer Ben, and thanks to you for listening. It only remains now for me to fade out the way I've always wanted to fade out.
Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. Then, should the warlike Harry, like himself,
The Guardian.